Hey, folks, I know there are lots of business owners who listen to this show. Maybe some of you never planned on running a business, but now here you are. One thing you've always got to keep in mind is how much you're spending on your operating costs. That's one of the first things we had to keep in mind with WTF. And with things costing more today than they did when we started, you want to keep your expenses down. To reduce costs and headaches, be smart and use NetSuite by Oracle, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. Reduce IT costs, cut the costs of maintaining multiple systems, improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/WTF for more. That's NetSuite, NetSuite.com/WTF.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fucking ears? What's going on? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome. I want a special shout out because occasionally, you know, I say hello to people on their bikes or in their cubicles or on the treadmill or at the gym or cleaning up or painting, or perhaps you're finishing that sculpture, or maybe you're just putting the final touches on that bunker, stocking up those shelves with canned goods and jerky. I don't know. I don't necessarily think that's my audience, but it's possible. But somebody said, how about those of us who are working in the lab? Well, how are you? Welcome to the show. Those of you who are busy at work in the lab, doing things with microscopes or vials. I see smoking blue liquid in test tubes, perhaps dissecting things, maybe just moving highly dangerous things from one place to another, wearing a suit of some kind. Welcome to you. I'm glad you have headsets in that hazmat suit. Welcome. Welcome, military people. Yesterday was Veterans Day. Got a little few emails, some tweets from people in the military saying thank you. Well, thank you. A lot of nice feedback for the Lorne Michaels episode. Some of you are saying, well, what happens now, man? You got Obama, you got Keith, you got Lorne Michaels in 1 year. What happens now, man? Well, I'll tell you what happens. I keep doing the show. I've got Elvis Costello on the show today. There's a lot of people that I admire and respect and am curious about their work, who they are. I don't feel like I'm running out of people. So we keep doing the show, okay? Did I mention Elvis Costello? I did. Elvis Costello. So anyways, a little squirrely. I'll be honest with you. Driving around my car, and I'm feeling relaxed because I enjoy driving. But, okay, I'm going to cop to it. I'm thinking, like, maybe a little weed would be nice. How about a little weed? I used to smoke weed every morning. I used to carry around a little one-hitter wooden pipe back before vapes and prescribed pot. I used to have a little wooden box with a sliding top and a little wooden pipe that only fit one hit or so in there, and I tuck into phone booths. That's the last time I smoked weed, is where you could still walk down the street and tuck into phone booths to load up your little one-hit pipe and do a little pull, a little hit. So I'm driving around thinking maybe a little weed, and when you're a sober person, you're like, shit, man, I shouldn't be thinking about weed. Where's that coming from? I better get to a secret society get together and get straight with my program. But I couldn't figure it out, man. I was feeling pretty good. Yeah, I'm still thinking about smoking weed. And then I put it together. This is what happened. I know why I wanted to smoke some weed. I know what reawakened that urge in my mind and in my heart, because, you know, weed's pretty good. So here's what happened. I got a new car, right? I got that Camry, the hybrid Camry. Comes with Sirius Radio, which was on a trial basis. Then my buddy Dean Del Rey goes, oh, you listen to the Grateful Dead channel? Now, I don't know, some of you know this about me, but I got a deadhead in me. I wear patchouli to this day. not because of the Grateful Dead, but because a witchy woman that I dated many years ago turned me on to the patchouli, and I've worn it ever since. Been wearing patchouli about 20 years, so it's not necessarily associated with the hippie thing. But I've been listening to the goddamn Grateful Dead channel on Sirius Radio almost nonstop every time I'm in the car. So of course I want to smoke weed. Wow, I had no idea. It wasn't an immediate trigger. It took about 2 weeks of listening to the same 14 songs in many different live versions over many different eras for me to start getting squirrely around the weed. I blame Sirius. I blame the Grateful Dead station for my relapsy-driven mind around the weed. I got a handle on it, though. I do like listening to the Grateful Dead sometimes, and I'm going to admit that. That's a secret between us. And I was reading Elvis Costello's book. He enjoys the Grateful Dead, too. I wish I would have got more time with him, but it was tight on the time. I was tight on the time with that one. I got another thing I want to tell you, but I'm nervous about talking about it because you asked for it, and I'll tell you about it. Let me catch you up on some stuff. There's been a few people that have been thinking like, well, Maron's not as candid as he used to be, or he's not talking about his life, or he's gotten too big. I don't know what you think I'm doing. I don't know what life you think I have. You know, I wake up, I've been interviewing people a lot, and then I go right, or I go to Whole Foods and I get aggravated. I go to Trader Joe's and I get aggravated. Why? Maybe you're wondering why I'm still aggravated. I don't fucking know, man. Things are good, but are they great? Yeah, they're pretty great. Is it a day-to-day struggle for me to keep my shit together mentally and emotionally? Yes. Am I still a little emotionally fucked up? Yes, I am. Is that what you want to hear? Will this make you feel better? Am I seething with anger for no reason and no place to put it a lot of times? Would meditation help that? Maybe. I haven't tried it yet. Have not tried it yet. Why am I holding out? Good question. Maybe because I'm attached to my discomfort. Is that what you want to hear? But also, like, I know there's some things going on with me because, okay, I'll be honest with you. I've been a little squirrely doing a lot of sets at the Comedy Store because that's what I do. I'm a stand-up comic, and I lost my shit. Not on stage. I lost my shit. It's been a long time since I lost my shit. It's been a long time since I felt the heat of rage gurgle up from my stomach, up through my chest, into my arms, and my eyes just go fucking red with fire intensity. And I feel my whole body gets enveloped in something that needs resolution. What happened was, a guy I know hangs around the store, comic, haven't seen him in a while. He was around a lot. I don't need to mention names because I don't want to. But I hadn't seen him. And, you know, I was walking out of the original room into the back hallway. He walked by me. I go, hey, what's up? And he just ices me, puts his hand up. He goes, eh. And I'm like, what? And he just kind of walks by. I'm like, what's the matter, man? He goes, eh. And I'm like, what the fuck? And I just walked up to him. I said, what, is there a fucking problem? What's going on? He's like, eh. And I'm like, what are you fucking doing? He's like, eh. And I'm like, what the fuck is your problem, man? He's like, eh. And I go, I don't get what you're doing. I don't get it. You got a problem? Let's talk about it. He goes, no, why don't you just go back up the hall? I didn't ask to talk to you. I said, don't you fucking tell me where to walk or what to do, bitch. I said that in a louder tone. So now let me set the scene with you. There are other comics in the hallway. And there was a woman, this woman, Molly, an agent from, ICM, who I talked to earlier in a very nice, charming tone, and she thought we were just kidding until she realized, oh no, Maron's fucking losing it, and I don't even know her. So she scrambles off, and he says, why don't you scroll back through your Twitter feed and find out? And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? What are you talking about? And he says, you couldn't just leave it. You had to show that you had more power than me. You just said, eh. And I'm like, I do not know what the fuck you're talking about. I don't know. I didn't know it was you or whatever. And I'm screaming. He's like, do you think this looks good? You yelling at a young comic. And I'm like, I don't give a fuck. What the fuck is your problem? Why you treat me like a fucking asshole? And he goes to walk off. And I said, let me see if I can be honest with you, because some of you feel like you're not getting honesty from me.
As he walked off, leaving me in a rage with no resolution, I said, you're a fucking cunt and you're not funny. And I walked back down the hall and everyone in the hallway was like, don't look in his eyes. Like, oh shit. Mommy and daddy just lost it. Just don't look in his, you know, like, and I felt the rage kind of easing. And then it sort of dissipated, but like I felt bad because I didn't want to lose my shit, but I also thought I was being, you know, provoked and he was treating me like an asshole and I lost my shit and I had no recollection of what the hell he was talking about, but I felt shitty because I don't want to lose my shit like that. Then I go back to talk to, like I was going back into the original room to do my set and I see that woman, Molly, and I'm like, hey, what's going on? Yeah, that got a little out of hand. And she's looking at me like, I don't know you and you're scary. And I'm like, oh my God, I know that face. I've seen that face. But you, here's the fucked up thing about rage is that you're in it and there's people around. And what does that look like? How fucking like crazy and scary is that shit? And I felt fucking embarrassed because like, you know, now I'm a crazy man. It was just embarrassing, and I, you know, and that's what happens when you build it up. You don't meditate. You drink too much coffee. You hold your feelings in. Whatever the fuck it is, it happened. I felt bad about it, and then I, you know, I did my set, and I said, "Look, man, you know, I'm sorry. I don't remember what you're talking about." And he goes, "Okay, I believe you, and you know, I'm sorry too. It got out of hand." I'm like, "I'm sorry. All right." I walked away. It was like a very reluctant but genuine apology. And then I went back home and I looked on my Twitter feed and, you know, somebody had said, you know, something, he was added in this request. Someone asked me to have him on the show and I said, eh. Like, I did know what I was doing and I was being a dick, but I didn't really think it would, like, cause that much trouble. I should just get off Twitter altogether. Because like I'm no different. I'm the same way. If somebody says something dismissive or shitty to me, you know, I get fucking worked up and, you know, this guy knows me and I know him and I said a shitty thing and I felt shitty about it. And, he was right. But nonetheless, there's a little personal story about Mark losing his shit in this great and prosperous time where everything should be going his way. Busy, drained, working hard, overwhelmed, shit builds up, I lose my mind on some dude. We made up, but it's a little clouded by the fact that I was a dick. And I guess I'm just wanted to tell you guys I'm still capable of that. And I'm sorry. So, that being said, we have Elvis Costello on the show today. And I read a little bit of his new book, which is Unfaithful Music and Disappearing Ink. It's out now. It's great. And I was excited to talk to him, but nervous because when I got to talk to people that have done a lot of work, you know, it's like, how are we going to get it in? Well, he was running a little late and he got here and we had literally an hour. He got here. He came with a guy I know, Eddie Gordetsky, comedy writer, and another guy. And they come in. And I'm like, you need water, you need tea. You know, I always have tea on hand for my British friends. And then he sees my espresso machine sitting on the counter. He goes, what's that? And I go, well, I can make you an espresso. He said, yeah. So I make him a double shot of espresso, which eats into the hour. He shoots it back like a goddamn shot of Jameson's. And we come out here and he just, right out of the gate, we're fucking going. We're up and running, man. So this is a very packed, an engaged hour with the maestro that is Elvis Costello. And I would like to mention that, I talked with Elvis. This actually took place a couple weeks ago. And we talked about blues legend, New Orleans artist, Alan Toussaint, who passed away this week, RIP. And I thought I should mention that because it had not happened when I talked to Elvis. So this is my conversation with Elvis Costello. Well, what do you think? Well, Peter Green plays big in your childhood, right?
Yeah, but you know, I didn't even register him until he was in Fleetwood Mac. I didn't know anything about him. A little bit too young for the blues boom.
Right,
I was a kid in where we lived was, you know, across the bridge from the Station Hotel.
Right.
We lived just a 150 yards from the Thames, and it was all happening around there.
Right.
You know, if I'd just been like a teenager, I would have had a ball, because it was, you know, over the bridge was the Station Hotel where the Stone started.
Sure.
There was a dirty old van that used to be parked in the next street.
Yeah.
That I never did find out, because you never see them in the hours of right. daylight. But they said it was the Yardbirds, or it just could have been their road crew.
Right.
You know? But as kids, we said, the Yardbirds live in the next street. And, you know, this van would have, I love Jeff, or I love Eric. I don't know whether
painted on there.
Written in the dust, yeah, you know, written in the dust, or a bit of lipstick or something. And because they were just breaking out of blues into being a pop group. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was Eel Pie Island that's just round the bend in the river.
Yeah.
So this is a hotbed of, you know, sort of blues into psychedelic music going on all around me. And I'm just, you know, I was 10 and 64.
So you're just
you know.
Starting to see the hippies going, and the long hair is going like, that looks interesting.
Yeah, but I was even like, this is even earlier, man. It's like 65, 66.
Oh, so
the people were only just getting long hair.
Right, right.
And sort of long hair like the Rolling Stones, not long hair like, you know, Woodstock, you know.
Well, it's sort of interesting though, because I've read about 170 pages.
Yeah,
I'm in.
Yeah,
I'm in.
You're in. You're not cutting back.
And, I think it's great. Unless something happens at page 200 and it just falls to shit, I think it's a great book.
Thank you. Yeah. No, I figured I'd hook him in early and get him in. And as you can tell, I had no intention of going, I was born, I did this, my drug hell, my conversion.
No, you go back and forth. It's interesting.
Because because you can read the other stuff, you know, I wrote 60,000 words of liner notes.
Yeah, of liner notes,
for various reissues.
Is that another book?
It's like episodic kind of telling of how we made the record. So this is more like how I heard music the way I did, because I traced it back to the seeing my dad when I was a little lad.
Sure, I think what was interesting is you're saying that you missed that first wave, the British blues boom, but because you grew up when you grew up, you sort of have access to your father's music, and then, you know, if you want to go back to the blues, you can, but the music that was happening, I was very surprised to see, you know, what was influencing you.
Well, it was, you know, it's, my parents met in a record shop. I mean, that's, you know, if your mom
worked there?
Yeah, she. This I'm talking about like 1949, 50. My mother worked in a record shop from 1943. She left school at 14. That's the first job she got. It's all the only job she knew.
Yeah,
and of course you had to learn the catalog inside out. Then you had to be able to recommend which is the version of this song. You know, there's five.
Was it classical or jazz?
No. You know, popular songs of the day, and they did have to learn. You know, even a shop girl had to know. They used to send her up to the Philharmonic Hall, and you had to learn about classical music. And
so she knew
it. She knew that, and had to. And she just had an interest in dance band music, which was the pop music of the day, you know, through the late 40s, and jazz. And my dad was among the musicians coming in, trying to play this crazy new music out of America, which was bebop.
Right.
Well, you know, my dad, you know, has to his name that he was Birkenhead. That's the little town opposite Liverpool. Birkenhead's leading and probably only bebop trumpet player. You know, there wasn't like a big jazz scene.
But you grew up with a musician father.
Yeah.
And you knew as you got older, you knew the pitfalls of that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah,
But do you find that, have you somehow broken the mold? Do you feel like
Well, not in certain ways, no. I mean, my dad was, he quickly found, like a lot of jazz musicians, that he could make. He happened to have a talent to be able to sing.
Yeah.
So, you know, he tried to go to London.
Yeah.
You know, had a cat under his arm like Dick Whittington, you know.
Right.
And my mother got a job. Actually, my mother did better than my dad. My mother got a job in Selfridge's department store, big, you know, really fancy department store.
Yeah.
And sold records there. My dad sort of struggled to get into jazz. So he took a job with a dance band, just playing in the section.
That's how he ended up with, what was the name of that guy?
Joe Loss Orchestra.
Yeah.
And then they discovered he could sing, and then they pushed him forward. He'll give you a couple of numbers as a vocalist. And next thing, he was appearing on the, you know, annual polls of vocalists, and he got headhunted by one of the top bands of the day. And they were a band like based on, you know, Glenn Miller. That's the kind of
music. But did he ever feel like a regret that he didn't pursue the more...
I talked about it with him when he was a lot older, you know, and because he knew all the names of all these great jazz musicians, the English ones,
sure.
Some of whom became world famous. And, you know, they were his sort of pals when he first came to London. But, you know, he had a really great career as a singer on the radio. He didn't record very much, so I don't have a lot of examples of him singing. He sang on the radio every week, and the way radio was set up in England then was very different than America. You know, we didn't have 12 or 24 hours of continuous pop radio, and lots of different stations with different call signs. We just had the BBC.
Right.
And they had all these funny regulations, funny agreements that had been made between the musicians' union and the performing. They could only play 5 hours of music a day. That's all recorded.
Because they had
music.
Live programming?
Because the rest of it had to be live to keep the musicians in work.
Right.
Of which, of course, my dad benefited from that. And so the BBC had a lot of BBC orchestra, BBC this, BBC that.
But they didn't
and
record it.
And no, it went out live. And then it was just gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So they were sort of like acted like a filter.
Right.
And of course, the groups, you know, of the day, the recording artists, were also obliged to go onto those shows and play live performances of the hits. How they got exposure, you know?
Right, yeah.
So when I was a young lad and I'd be off school, I'd go with my dad.
Yeah.
And that was the thrill, you know, because although I was going, you know, it's like take your kid to day.
Yeah, yeah.
Take your kid to work day.
And you were in show business. It was show business.
Yeah, well, I'd been to the dance hall with them on a Saturday and seen how it worked. Then to get to go to the broadcast, the real hook for me to go there, as much as I'd like to see my dad work, was that... There'd be a group of the day on who were more the music that I actually wanted to listen to. You know,
who'd you see?
Mersey Beats, the Hollies. You know,
saw the Hollies.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the Hollies come in. I mean, the guys who were in the band with my dad was about 37 then.
Sure,
but you know,
it's old timey in a way.
Some of the men in the band were maybe as much as 50.
Yeah, yeah.
But they all seemed like old when you're 10. Sure, you can't tell how old I mean. Yeah. And then suddenly these scruffy guys come in carrying their own equipment. And I've written in the book, like, I really remember Tony Hicks, the guitar player. He just had a sweater on. He didn't have a jacket on with a hole in the elbow.
Yeah.
I don't know why it stuck in my head all these years, because I just went, oh, he's like a kid like me. You know, and it was like a thing where just the light went on. I could be like that, you know, because I think he was only 18.
When you were writing the book, how much did you learn about yourself in the process of digging out? Like, because like, for me to see that, you know, that you were compulsively playing Neil Young music at the beginning... I mean, is that something you've always carried with you and talked about, or did you realize things about yourself? The fact that you were excited to see Little Feet, I found not jarring, but just sort of like, really, Elvis?
Well, it's not really what the people, you know, people get you a little, if they just know you a little bit, then they just know that one type of music you play. They don't ever think about what other music you might
I can see
like,
it.
You know?
I mean, I can see, like, it seems to me that, you know, you mentioned Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Neil Young, Little Feet, and then you mentioned some country music. I mean, it all seems to inform what you ended up doing your entire life. Van Morrison.
It's just the way you hear it. I just think some of the music that was in the house when I was just a little kid that's playing, your parents are choosing. That's why I never heard rock and roll, because my parents were tuned into Frank Sinatra and bebop.
But they didn't strike me as conservative
people.
They
weren't conservative. It just wasn't interesting to them. They didn't think it was bad music.
Right.
This was the other music that were more concerned. And then my dad was obliged to learn whatever was in the hit parade, whether it was... You know, It's Not Unusual by Tom Jones or, you know, Like a Rolling Stone. I mean, really, I know it's hard to imagine that they process these songs through these swing bands, you know.
Did you ever cover It's Not Unusual?
I never did.
Well, it just struck me.
What's New Pussycat would be my speed, I think. So you know, all the way through the 60s, I was hearing music two ways. I'm hearing it on the radio like all my friends, and I'm hearing it in the front room, my dad learning it off these same records. Many of them A-labels, advance releases.
Would you have heard Burt Bacharach then?
Yeah, definitely.
In your parents' collection?
No. That would be just something my dad would have brought home to learn. I mean, the songs, I don't know who, sung by who, Billy J. Kramer, singing Trains and Boats and Planes, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, all those songs were hits maybe once or twice over, because we'd get the English version, then we'd get the American original come out.
Sure.
You know? That's why all that music went in so deep, because we had English beat groups, as they were called, which were sort of the second generation rock and roll band, English ones. Yeah, the Beatles, they got hold of Chuck Berry songs and Miracle songs. But if you were a 10-year-old Beatles fan, you thought they wrote those songs. I didn't, until I checked the credits, I didn't know who wrote them. I just knew they wrote songs. I thought they wrote everything, you know.
But it seems to me that when, not unlike, I guess, a lot of people, that when you heard the Beatles, you knew that something, you know, was magical going on.
Well, it hit me. That was the first record. The first record I ever asked my dad for, from the ones he would bring home to learn to sing on the radio. He was learning Please Please Me in the front room in 63.
And what was it? Was it just the
harmony? I think it was the harmony. I think it was the vocal harmony. The way, you know, it's a peculiar sort of little vocal trick where there's just one note being stated all the time. And it just did something to me. And I suppose then you discover that you have certain dispositions. And you don't, you know, at 10, you don't analyze any of that stuff. You don't know the names for music, musical terms.
And you spent you spent time in the book, and it seems to be recurring through the book, about the death of a friend of yours when you were a kid.
Well, that was a lot later on. You know, that was what really...
How old were you?
17.
And you saw that happen?
Yeah.
What happened?
He, you know, we were just in a school annex, yeah, 300 yards, and he was just jokingly saying, give us a lift to one of the teachers. Yeah. He ran out in the road. It was sort of thing that you wouldn't expect to happen to a 17-year-old. He just didn't see the car. And, you know, it was very shocking to all of us. And, you know, I think now when I look at it, he was a, you know, a good friend, and he was a photographer as well. And he, took, there's a picture in the book that he took of us in the class, and I'm in the middle of this bunch of schoolboys playing the guitar. And, you know, he was sort of, you know, he was always getting at me, you've got to sing Working Class Hero. And I said, I can't sing that. It's like, I'm not working class. My family came from
working class. So this is like 69, 70, 71?
It's 71.
Yeah.
And he was on at me about singing that song. And I said, and he was like, it's really good because it says fucking in it, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And he'd like that, you know. And he would get up and sing it in front of people and horrify them. And,
right.
And I learned it, but I mean, I never felt convinced in singing it. I said, John Lennon, he wasn't really working class either. He was like, come sort of like, I suppose the definitions are all different in England.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody really had a very different kind of life. And then, you know, after he died, I think I sort of, it just woke me up to the fact that you should do the thing you really love most of all, you know.
So you felt
because
his,
life was a little bit, you know, more fragile than you think. Because when you're 17, you think you're immortal. You
know? And just to see that happen in front of you.
It was a really, really, and you know, it was only very recently his sister got back in touch with me and gave me the picture that's in the book. And she had heard that I was working on a book. And that was really beautiful because, you know, she gave me this picture and I had no memory that he'd taken it. I remembered he took photographs, but I never remembered that he took a picture of me. And it just, you know, it was a nice connection to the way I was thinking about it.
And you hadn't seen her in 30, 40 years?
No, I still haven't seen her. We've corresponded with one another, yeah.
It was his only sister?
At that age, you don't talk about your families very much.
You just run into people at school, yeah.
Well, I think we didn't talk about our feelings and all that sort of stuff. It just wasn't what you did. Maybe we're English, you know, we don't really do that sort of thing. he was like me. I think he was Anglo-Irish, you know.
So there
was a little bit of a different sort of combination, cocktail of emotions.
And do you think that in retrospect, outside of just learning the existential realities of life is short, that the grief of that or the shock of that sort of stayed with you?
No. I thought I'm not going to go to college and learn to do something I don't really want to do. I'm going to, you know.
Yeah.
My dad was a musician. There'd been a guitar in the corner of my room since I was nine.
What kind?
Spanish guitar. My parents and
nylon string.
It was originally, and then I fucked it up by putting steel strings on it. When I was about, I don't know, whatever year, what 19? I was 14.
Yeah.
Man of the World came out with Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
The real Fleetwood Mac.
Oh my God.
And that was this, you know, this you mentioned a while ago, Peter Green.
Yeah.
And Peter Green was somebody that I saw him once in our local record shop. He was like this hippie Jesus.
He
had this amazing look with a rugby shirt and this long hair and beard. And he sang in this really soulful way. And I didn't know until later that he'd played in a legit blues band, you know, playing
Otis Rush.
I just knew these records that suddenly hit. And it was like he'd got hold of something from the blues and really made some original, I guess we'd call it rock music now.
It's heavy though, man.
Nobody really called it rock music then, I remember. It was sort of like progressive, I think.
There's something about the tone of his voice though,
right? Yeah, and it was really, you know, he sang what I later realized was a Little Willie John song, I Need Your Love So Bad. That was the one that's the only guitar solo I've ever learned how to play. And I never could play it well.
That was from like one of the first two of the Fleetwood Mac albums. There's only like three.
And that was after I've heard the song Man of the World, and I suppose it appealed to a, you know, romantic 14-year-old.
Right.
And this let me tell you about my life. You know, they say I'm a man of the world. It was a totally improbable song.
Yeah.
And somebody at my school, an older kid, I think, had the chord changes written out in chord symbols.
Yeah.
And I was so obsessed with this song that I sat down and took my guitar out, which I'd never bothered with, never learned to play one chord on. And taught myself to play that one song.
At 17 or 14? How old?
14.
14.
Yeah.
Well, I think the power of like Peter Green's voice was, it's almost heartbreaking somehow.
Yeah. I think he's still one of my very favorite singers. I mean, a very underrated.
Yeah.
I mean, he just wrote the most original, so almost like another version of rock music that never really got picked up by anybody.
Did you ever meet him?
I didn't ever meet him to talk.
Because he's still around.
Yeah, I saw a picture of him recently looking well because he had a period where he was not well. And I did see, that's when I saw him. I mean, he would appear standing kind of like rather an apparition and not looking very well.
Right.
And that was kind of heartbreaking because I'd seen him this one time looking really heroic.
Yeah.
And then just moved to pick up the guitar just because of what he played.
Because of Peter. I love hearing that.
And then I saw him later, you know, just standing in the street looking kind of almost like he was in a trance and not looking in very good shape at all. And I think he had some problems that they eventually, you know.
Well, there's a BBC documentary called Man of the World.
Yeah.
About his sort of finding him.
Yeah, and sort of, I think it was one of those things of people misdiagnosing him and having him on the wrong medications.
You know that?
I mean, people were quick to say, oh, it was excessive, and there may have been something, but I don't know anything about that, so I can't say what the truth is.
I heard, someone told me, and I don't know if it's true, that B.B. King said that Peter Green was the only guitar player that ever made him cry.
Well, that's a, you know, that's
it's great.
You know,
right?
For me, all the other, you know, guys who were sort of, you know, English blues guitar players, they are all, there's many admirable musicians among them, but the only one that really moves me and I, you know, I've ever really spent any time listening to
is
Peter Green.
I'm with you on that.
And he
actually was the guy that inspired you to play guitar.
Yeah, even though I never wanted to play solo lines. I mean, that was the other thing. It was like he was a songwriter.
Yeah.
And he had this sort of strange, fatalistic, romantic sound which appealed to me at that age, and I still love the song, and it has a little suspension in it and these little tricks. So once I learned all the chords, I mean, there might be 9 chords in that song, far more than you would ever have to learn from the average campfire song,
sure, or a blues song even.
I never ever wanted to play blues in that way, so I then found I could tear through all these songs, which up until then had just been on records. Like, I could play Beatles songs. These are actually a lot simpler than I thought. You know, they seem beyond me, because when you're a kid, I think you just accept everything all at once. You don't pick it apart.
So you're self-taught by chord charts? I mean, you were
And then I bought these songbooks, which had simplified changes because they were cheaper.
Yeah.
And they just were beginner's books. And then my ear told me the chords were wrong. And then I'd sneak into the shop and look at where the diminished chords were and all these major sevenths, and, you know, learned gradually about harmony.
And also you learned how to play lead somewhere.
No, I never did, really.
You can play lead.
I just put my fingers anywhere and hope for the best.
Come on.
I mean, no, it's true.
So you're always just a melody guy?
In my head I can hear complicated harmony.
Yeah.
And I still have deliberately not learned the guitar, and I never played scales.
Yeah.
Or certainly never blues scales. I just play instinctively what I hear, and I think it's good having like a complicated head for the accompanying harmony.
But there are some leads on your records.
Yeah, but they're all just sort of luck. My old musical partner from Liverpool when I was 17 said every solo I launched into, I'd say I had a rabbit's foot in my jacket pocket to get me through it. And I never thought of myself as a guitar player. I couldn't get a job in anybody else's band.
Yeah.
But just some things I hear.
That's a gift.
And then I work out where they are on the guitar. And I left the idiot part of the guitar playing.
Yeah.
Because it's important. I mean, that's the noble tradition.
Well, you find your feel through what you do.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's like the big stupid riff is the thing I like.
Yeah.
And that just works for certain kinds of song. And then I can hear all the other stuff and arrange all the parts, you know, and tell people what to play, or even I've learned to write it down. But with the guitar, you want to really just keep alive the inner link, Ray, you know.
When you look at yourself in retrospect of your entire career, do you see yourself as a band leader to some degree?
Songwriter.
That's what you call
yourself. Band leader, maybe second.
Arranger.
I guess that's what it's called, but I didn't think
because
of that.
I was looking at some stuff and I was trying to figure out, you didn't do a lot of producing on your own, right?
No.
It was not a thing you wanted to do.
I only ever wanted to stop other people fucking up the groups, and I liked, like, the Specials particularly, that.
Yeah.
I really loved them.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I was between, it was like the 3 or 4 weeks between albums or tours, you know.
Right.
Working pretty consistently then. And I just wanted to make sure that nobody polished them up beyond what I loved about them when I heard them live. And I just turned up the faders and they did it.
And you did the first record of the Specials and the first Pogues record.
Same sort of thing. It was like there were some parts I had to play,
because
there were some players that could play really well and some players that couldn't play at all.
Right.
But it kind of worked, you know, and it had this, both those records was very similar, and they were just like a electric. Even though some cases no electric instruments on it. They had
Well, the Pogues, a lot of acoustic stuff on that first record.
But it was like driven by the incredible words.
Yeah, it was a hell of a record. Yeah. So you were in a duo for a while with that guy you just mentioned.
Yeah.
What was his name?
Alan Mays.
Where'd he end up?
He ended up in Austin, Texas. We reformed our group last night.
I
was on this book tour, and I rang him up and said, you know, I've been showing pictures from trying to locate the apprenticeship of music. And I said, I've got a picture of us playing to a bunch of totally bewildered looking middle-aged people at a poetry society in Liverpool in 71. And I've got like a stripy sweater on, like a member of the Standells.
Yeah.
And he's like much more, he was always a more confident, more polished player. And I said, and he gave me a demo tape that he had kept.
Just the other day?
No, he gave it to me ages ago. And I didn't know anything about recording.
Yeah.
It was a tape recorder I got from my dad. I didn't know you were supposed to clean the heads.
Right.
So that even though the thing is recorded in 1971, it sounds like it's recorded in 1935. You know, it's like, it's all muffly.
What was the experience of listening to that?
Well, you know, I could hear who we liked.
Could you hear yourself, though?
On certain notes, on certain kind of phrases, and there's something in that that's just you're born with, and then.
And when did you get back together with him? Yesterday?
Yeah, and I said, I'm telling the story. There's a bit in the book where I'm saying, some of the comical things that happened in your apprenticeship, and I thought, wouldn't it, be great if when I say this story, if I just pull the curtain back, and then we do it right now, and it was a joyful thing to sing again. You know, we just sang this song I wrote when I was 17. And
really?
We sang a Van Morrison song that we used to do.
Which Van Morrison song?
Domino.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I know you're a big Astral Weeks fan.
Yeah, but you could never play that music.
Yeah,
you couldn't cover that music.
Yeah,
whereas
the
ones from, truthfully, the Band and Street Choir record was where I stole all the rhythms from My Aim Is True. But nobody kind of caught that because they were convinced I was something to do with the London thing.
Well, you said something very interesting in the book about, you know, when you try to sound like somebody else, that's where you might sort of happen upon your own sound because you're doing it badly.
That's almost certainly it, yeah. I mean, I would hear like You Ain't Living Until You're Loving by Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. I didn't even know how many instruments were on that record. Even when I was a professional musician, I thought it was an orchestra.
Right.
When I went to Hitsville to visit in the early 80s and I found the room was only the same size as the studios that I'd recorded, I was astounded. I thought it must be a big cathedral of a place. Because it just, in my imagination, it always sounded so huge.
Well, so when you were a kid, you're listening to that, or as you're becoming a more proficient musician, you're listening to the Motown stuff and you're listening to...
We never called it Motown.
I know. What'd you call it?
We called it Tamla.
Why?
I don't know. It was a convention.
But it had nothing to do with anything? You can't trace
Tamla
that
Motown.
Word?
Tamla Motown. That was the name. And they said Tamla on the label.
On the label. Yeah. So there was a label thing.
Yeah.
When they were imported, they said Tamla.
Yeah, there's Tamla. It was like, you got any Tamla records? You know, I never heard Motown until much later.
Where did the love for, how did you get to country?
That was a little bit later. It was really I really loved the Byrds.
Okay.
The Byrds, you know.
Graham Parsons.
I liked all this all those groups, you know, through the 60s, the English ones.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously the Beatles.
Yeah.
The Stones more the later records, you know, like Aftermath, not so much the real
like
blues
Beggars
records. Even before that, Aftermath, Between the Buttons, those I definitely, you know, took them apart and put them back together in my own way. The Small Faces, the Faces, the Small Faces
with Steve Marriott,
the Kinks, because they told stories, you know. And then the American group who really spoke to me first of really all the 60s groups, the Byrds, and I liked everything they did, you know, when they were folk rock and then they were raga rock and then there was space rock and then every record had another name. And I suppose now I realize that was probably as silly as I put my records out, this is new wave. We never said that. That was just made up by an A&R man or something. You know?
Yeah, but you never sought out to work with McGuinn?
I did work with
you
McGuinn.
You did? On which record?
McGuinn plays on the first track on Spike.
Oh, he did?
Yeah, it's the three Macs.
Yeah.
It's McCartney, McGuinn, and me.
Oh.
Yeah.
Was that a big day?
They weren't in the room together, but they recorded their parts separately. But it was, I said in the book, I said, when you were jumping ahead, but, you know, after I made all the records with the Attractions, which were, for the main part, combo records, where we just played in the room.
What do you consider the last Attractions record?
Imperial Bedroom.
Oh, what a great
record. I mean, we all played together on the records. That's really the last one. Well, I suppose Blood and Chocolate is an Attractions record, but it's that we're working a kind of against ourselves there. That's how it kind of sounds tense and like good like it is.
Right. You know? So because you're at odds?
Well, they weren't very happy about me working with T-Bone Burnett in the year before. They didn't, you know, that sort of blew. But we had already kind of run out of the formula of working together, and yet we couldn't break the habit. It was the truth of it, you know.
So what did, because I know, like, I had Nick Lowe in here, yeah. And like, it's very hard for me to manage musical history, especially, yeah. You know, someone who's been at it as long as you. And I talked to Nick, but I didn't. Where did that whole what facilitated the change that enabled you to sort of be so defined in the moment that you were defined? Because there was it seemed like the sound of England was changing, all the music that was coming out, mm-hmm. of there, the pop music that they were calling away. But you, the Squeeze, and a few other bands were honoring, you know, some very sophisticated pop music.
Well, as the way I see it,
yeah.
is that we had the 60s and all these like very tight, like short records, yeah. like the Small Faces and the Kinks, yeah. and obviously the primary, the Beatles. And then there was psychedelic music and then progressive and right. prog rock and all these.
Was that ever your thing?
Never.
Yeah, and, couldn't see
and,
it.
And so the R&B thing really yeah. kind of carried me through, and what they called wooden music, you know, West Coast American folk music.
Laurel more Canyon stuff?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. More introspective. So those two things for me were running along parallel.
Right.
I moved to Liverpool to finish my schooling in 1970
yeah.
and discovered that nobody in the school would admit to liking Tamla or Stax. That was kind of, as people saying, that's music for divvies. And,
what's a divvy?
Sort of like leery, kind of stupid. And oh. I went, because I guess, you know.
They were all into
like hooligans right. liked it, you know. Oh, and right. I went, no, but that's what we've been, you know, at different parts of the country, you have different tastes.
Yeah.
And, there were, you know, I listened to a lot of Rocksteady and early reggae before yeah. the Rasta reggae kind of
that hit, was mu- that was much more popular early
very
on
very popular
in
it was like
England.
The second string right. music really it was almost right. like another kind of R&B
right
it was like the underlying
we
music.
Didn't get that here till much
it
later
never really caught on no. That's why Americans can't play it
yeah. right
and the so we had all that music that's the sort of dance teenage dance music
sure like dub music too
what you call Motown no long before dub
yeah
you know and all these like records on the Trojan label long before we even heard of the Wailers, you know?
Yeah.
And then I went to Liverpool and everybody was listening to psychedelic music. They listened to whole sides of Pink Floyd. I could never, it was bewildered me that music.
Right.
I liked,
well, did you think it was a waste of time or?
Yeah.
Didn't
sound, okay. It took a long time. I knew that, you know, I like See Emily Play. I love See Emily Play right. and Art right. Lane. And after that, I just glazed over, you know, and Led Zeppelin, I couldn't I thought, if you want to listen to that, why didn't you just listen to Howlin' Wolf? You know
right.
I mean?
It's yeah, like, it's, okay. Yeah.
You know,
the first two records.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I just couldn't get it. So I went the other way. I went super quiet and I liked all, you know, and.
Well, you know what's interesting about
you know,
that
Johnny
is that.
Mitchell
you know who else was like that?
People. Who?
I had Huey Lewis in here. And Huey grew up in the hippie zone.
Yeah.
He grew up in like.
In Marin. Yeah.
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 And he was an R&B guy. He didn't yeah. like the hippie shit. And it turns out that like the band he was with backed you on the first record,
yeah,
right?
He was down the pub.
Yeah,
chasing,
right.
chasing girls, probably. I don't know what he was up
so
to.
He said,
him and the two singers from Clover, I mean, they were. Yeah. This band was a sort of a cult band that had a couple of records. They were persuaded by my first manager, Jake Riviera, to come and seek their fortune in London at probably the worst time that an accomplished...
The end of the pub rock business?
Yeah, the pub rock, as it was called. I don't remember anybody ever calling it that.
What was that, though? I don't even know what
well,
it was.
I mean, to you all in America, you yeah. know, it's a very... I know that I came to understand that music was played in bars, and so
right.
how bars sounded kind of cooler
yeah.
than...
But like, who were the bands?
Pubs. Well, they were bands like the one Nick Lowe was in,
Clover.
Brinsley Schwartz.
Yeah. Brinsley Schwartz.
And
you liked them, though, right?
Oh yeah. They were the band that I really, you know.
That was Nick Lowe's band, right?
Yeah. Well, he was the main songwriter.
Yeah.
And the and then you know Clover were this band that people whispered about. Have you heard Clover? Have you got your record? Was really hard to get.
It was an American band.
American band, and they in. Really after the moment that they should have come to London, they were persuaded to come to London. They were signed to a major record label.
Yeah.
So they were doing better than me.
Right.
I was still working in an office and I was making demos really for Stiff Records.
You didn't have a band?
No, I didn't have a band. So they said, well, you can use the drummer and John McPhee, the guitar player, and Nick Lowe will play bass and he's going to produce these two songs. And they saw something in that. And then I'd turn up at the office with a tape with another five songs on it, and then we'll record these four. So now you've got to go. We learned the first two just in the studio.
What was the first song you wrote?
The first one I recorded was Radio Sweetheart,
uh-huh.
which wasn't on an album, it was just on a B-side, and Mystery Dance.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, which was on mine. It was true eventually.
That's it. Like, that's actually the first song of yours. That, like, because I got your first record in a box of records that was given to me by, I worked at a restaurant, and the record store next door catered primarily to disco and dance music and R&B, and had all these rock records. They're like, we don't know what to do with them. And I took them, and that was the year your first record came out, and I put it on. I was like, what the fuck is this? Who's this guy? This is amazing.
That's what we thought. But, you know, it was...
But I'm a Chuck Berry head, so Mystery Dance, I was like, that's
it was a
shit.
Rock and roll model, you know, and I had all these crazy ideas that I knew, it was, to me, it was a novelty song.
Right.
And I couldn't understand...
Like a play on an old song?
It was sort of a play on an old song. So I wanted to make it sound as modern as possible, so I played it all downstrokes. I didn't want it to swing. I mean, all things that are completely wrong about rock and roll. Nick just ignored me and had the band play it the way he heard it, and it came out sounding great.
Well, he comes from that. Like, him and Dave Edmonds are, they bounce like that.
It was really a demo for Dave Edmonds. It was a demo.
Oh, really?
A demo.
You had it in mind for him?
Well, I didn't. They did.
Oh, really?
And they didn't really see how I fitted in because I didn't look like I should be in a group, you know? I
mean,
So anyway, they would then send me to the country to this house where Clover had been, because some of the guys in Clover had families.
Yeah.
So they were living in the getting it together in the country style out of this place called Headley Grange.
Uh-huh.
Which had previously been used by Led Zeppelin and Bad Company and these groups to get it together, you know. I think Stairway to Heaven was written there.
Oh, really?
The words, you know, the ghost of Robert Plant would lurk in the West Wing, you know.
And he's still alive. That's what's weird.
Yeah, that was strange. So I'd go down there and I'd have to spend the night and we'd rehearse the songs.
And you're this little kid, in a way.
Well, I wasn't really. I was working in an office. I was 21, 22.
Was that when you were working for the cologne company?
I was working for Elizabeth Arden.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I was, you know, it was in the day I was in an air-conditioned cubicle with a little computer, which is way, you know, it couldn't do anything your phone can do.
So
like very primitive computer.
Took up the whole room.
Whole room, chatter away. And I could bullshit like crazy about the computer. It's not ready. It's in a bad mood. I'd make up all things. Leave me alone. I'm writing these songs. And then I'd written all these tunes. I'd take them down, show them to these guys who were way more accomplished than anybody I'd played with. And they would, you know, play it back to me sort of a little bit different than I heard it in my head, truthfully. A little bit slicker, a little bit slower as well, more swinging. And the common ground I found was like the guitar player, John McPhee, I knew he'd played on a Van Morrison record. So that was exciting to me, you know.
Sure.
And their own records, the Clover records, I really dug them, but they weren't the kind of music I was trying to write, you know, which was a little bit faster. So then we'd go up to this tiny little studio pathway, and it was like, really, this room was generous in space.
I mean,
if you imagine a whole band in a room of this size.
Right.
So, of course, every instrument went onto every other instrument, and that's usually a bad thing.
Right.
But for some reason, in this little space, the fact that the drums could be heard on my vocal might create some sort of weird excitement. And actually, when you go back and look at most of the historic recording studios,
they're like that.
That sort of has some freak thing, like Sun is like that. And
so you played all that live to tape?
Yeah, pretty much live. Yeah. I mean, I think the only thing I dubbed on, say, Mystery Dance was the piano, because we didn't have a piano player. So I could just about play the part.
Right.
But I couldn't do the sweep down the keys like Jerry Lee. So Nick Lowe had to stand there with the drumstick. And I said, now! And he's like, he'd run it down the keys. You know, so like, I mean, just totally like held together with pieces of sticky tape.
But clearly the energy you brought to it and the menace of everyone on top of each other made it
the electric thing. And it was, you know, when it's played loud to you and you've not been in a studio with competent musicians before, it's very thrilling.
Sure.
Then you take it home, and I played it on my little same tape recorder I was telling you about, where I hadn't cleaned the heads for 20 years. And I goes, oh, it sounds a bit muted, you know. And I remember coming home and thinking, oh, it doesn't sound quite as good. Because it's not coming through these giant speakers.
Monitors.
And with Nick Lowe shouting, you know, it's great, you know, because that was his style of producing.
How did you build that relationship with him? He saw you or what?
Well, I'd been this kid that was sort of hanging around his group from, say, 73 to 76.
Right. That's so those what 3 years. You were just hanging around.
I was just being annoying guy. That's that guy again. He's going to start asking me questions about songwriting. And little by little, I've got something here that's okay, you know. And the group he was in, they dug out a lot of old songs.
Yeah.
So I had this mixture of lots of old songs going around in my head and the new ones I was trying to write. And I beat somebody different every week. You know, right. I thought it was going to be John Prine, then I thought it was going to be Randy Newman, then I thought it was going to be Lowell George, then I thought it was going to be...
You kind of hear that on that first record a little. Well, I mean, you did a reggae bit, and you did a sort of a country bit, right? Allison is relatively country, right?
Well, to me, it was based on... Do you want to know what it was based on?
Sure.
It was based on Ghetto Child by what you call the Spinners, what we call the Detroit Spinners.
Okay. And then you had Mystery Dance, and then... Yeah,
that was there were like some rock and roll songs.
Yeah, yeah.
I could tell you, you know, who I thought we were sounding like, but of course, filtered through this American band, it came out sounding kind of different.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, when they eventually decided that I was a recording artist and not just a backroom songwriter, they said, you've got to quit your job and we've got to form a band. We're going to put this album out. Can you go professional?
Right. But you couldn't take that band.
Well, I couldn't say that band had already a tour planned, and they had their own album coming out.
Right.
I had a family, so I couldn't just...
You had one child then?
Yeah, and I couldn't just quit and just do what I wanted. I had to say, well, can you pay me enough money, the same money as I'm earning? I wasn't earning a lot of money. And they said, yes, we can. And they gave me, I think they gave me £100 and a battery-powered amplifier. That was my, you know, and I went and bought back... With the money that they gave me, I went back and bought all the records I'd had to sell to pay the bills, you know.
Like, just to get it back in your head?
Yeah, just to get a few records that I had to part with. I think I'd had a couple of Beatles records that I'd had to get rid of, you know. The ones I kept my With the Beatles and I kept my, you know, Revolver, but maybe I'd let, you know, Beatles for Sale go or something.
Right.
You know?
So now, like, how much do you think you were driven? Do you think that if you didn't have the family, it would have been a completely different life for you? I mean, were you like, because I talk to guys, there's a difference between someone who knows they have to provide, certainly, and somebody who's just sort of like, nah, I can do whatever I want.
There's one side of my family that's kind of a dreamy, kind of doesn't have any sense of responsibility. My dad, actually.
Yeah.
Then my grandfather, before him, he traveled as well. He was also a musician. He was a ship's musician.
Yeah.
But my other grandfather was like a guy who came out of, you know, the First World War and then never was out of work until he died.
Right.
I'm a bit like him.
Uh-huh.
I've worked every day of my life since I was 17.
So lucky you got that.
Yeah, I've got that Protestant work ethic, yeah.
So to put together the Attractions, what became the Attractions, how did that happen?
Advert in the musical papers, you know.
Do you want to be in a
rocking combo or something? I don't know. No time wasters. They would have all these sayings, you know. Like,
sure.
You know, they would do,
and you audition people? Or these?
We did. We auditioned, you know. Pete Thomas was always going to be the drummer.
I see him around.
He'd been living in...
He's still playing with you now, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. He'd been living in California for a couple of years. He'd been playing with John Stewart. Not the satirical John Stewart, Daydream Believer.
Right.
And so he'd had an experience of living in Topanga and living in Marin.
Uh-huh.
And he'd been persuaded to come back to London, really, to be in my band. And the other two guys we found just out of the want ads, you know.
And Steve, it seems like your relationship with this band, you know, really sort of collaboratively built the sound that you become known for, right?
I mean, Steve was a very accomplished musician, even though he was very young. He was much younger than us. I think he was 18. Actually.
So he was like the wizard? Everyone was sort of like, oh my God.
I didn't have to really play anything. That's why you say about guitar playing.
Yeah.
When you got a guy, you know, to your right, who's playing all these incredible things, I let him take it. And the bass player, Bruce, was also very active. He didn't hardly play the bass, really. He just sort of played it was like playing cello or something.
Uh-huh.
He was always playing melodies, which were great.
Right.
And between us, we sort of, you know, a lot of great, and particularly English rock and roll bands, don't take the conventional roles. Think about The Who.
Yeah.
What kind of thing is that? You know, you've got a guy soloing the whole time and another guy
drummer
playing big chords on the bass. And then this other, you know, it's completely, it shouldn't make sense. And we sort of took the confidence to go that way. We didn't feel like we had to be like any other group.
So when it seems that you are capable of very elaborate melodies. Is that something that you did on your own or did you kind of pick up stuff from the band? Like,
No. I wrote all the songs. I mean, nobody else could write the songs.
Well, no, not write the actual lyrics.
But all the music.
Oh, really?
No, they couldn't. None of them really. Steve can write.
Yeah.
But they were not songwriters and they could sometimes conceive parts, but they had to have the chord structure to do that. So, once in a while, I'd give them a riff and they would syncopate it in some way. You know, like there would be a little way to deliver it that became distinctive. But the number of records in which they did that were much smaller than the ones in which I dictated all the parts.
Sure. So you arc. You do Miami's True, this year's Model Armed Forces, Get Happy, and that's like an arc of the attractions. And then you, what makes you do a country record in the middle of all that of covers?
Heartbreak. Really. I mean, it was like I got, you know, I'd made a lot of stupid mistakes, you know, on the road, and got my, you know, myself in a lot of trouble. And
like your dad.
I suppose it was. I never ever thought, oh, you know, thanks, Dad. You made me do this. I never ever thought. You know, never blamed him. You got to
No. But I mean, like, isn't it interesting to you in some way?
Well, when they're writing it down, obviously it was, because you know, they later learned that, that perhaps it was something in him that we both had. But and I knew it was there.
Yeah,
and I could see it in some of the songs, and it kind of pissed me off that I wrote these things that were predictions of the mistakes I made.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Allison and Strange in the House and these early songs. I sort of thought, I wrote them almost to like scare away the ghosts, you know.
So you had a sensitivity to it, to your own.
I wouldn't call it sensitivity.
But I mean, in order to sort of know that you had that in your heart before it happened.
That's something that maybe songwriters can have. It's not a very necessarily an admirable quality, but it's you know, I can see it now with the benefit of hindsight. And then, you know, then you try to work out in the best way you can. If you can't explain yourself and you can't be forgiven, then I suppose you work some of the ideas out and the complexity of it in lyrics, hoping that other people maybe get something from it. I mean, the reason to sing about stuff out loud is not just to indulge yourself or to write your diary, because you're taking feelings or experiences you had and probably sometimes displacing them a little bit, putting them in a voice of a character, changing whether you're saying it in first person or third person.
Well, that's what always blew me away. When I had Nick in here and he played the, you know, the Beast in Me, you know, sitting right there on an acoustic, like I always assume, like, man, this guy's lived it.
But did he tell you the story? Did he tell you the story about writing it?
And for Johnny Cash,
right? In the middle of the night. And he tells a story about, you know, in the middle of the night, he was Johnny Cash.
Oh.
You know, emboldened by maybe a few drinks. He thought himself into the character that he was trying to create.
But that's the first time I ever learned that songwriters write in character. Like, I never thought of that. I always thought that everybody was a first person guy.
There's a difference, isn't it? I mean, the first music that I was aware of, I didn't know who'd written it. It was like Frank Sinatra was singing, I've Got You Under My Skin.
Right.
But later on, when I got curious as to who wrote those songs and I wanted to write in that way.
Yeah.
You know, that with that little bit of romantic distance, you discover that those songwriters put a lot of heart and soul. And if you really get down deep into the biographies of Lorenz Hart and Johnny Mercer, you'll find all these really heartbreaking stories about what lies behind songs we take for granted that don't seem that personal because we've heard them so many times.
Sure.
And their skill was to put everything they knew and felt into songs that could be universally understood. When you get into the 1960s, you've got Smokey Robinson singing "I Second That Emotion," which is a catchphrase that summons up a load of ideas that you feel when you hear it. And you've got Joni Mitchell singing "The Last Time I Saw Richard," which is describing something that's obviously a very literal scene that you can't actually say, "I've lived that."
Right.
It's not like you're singing. It's not an everyman kind of subject. I learned from both things.
Right.
I learned from, well, all of those things. I learned from Lorenz Hart. I learned from Lennon and McCartney, learned from Smokey Robinson. But when the door opens in the 60s to very different ways to write, the possibility of writing very specific experiences, you then have to judge how well you can do that. And obviously, Joni Mitchell did it incredibly well.
What does that depend on? What's the balance?
Well, it depends on being a genius, I guess, because which I'm not. You know,
I don't know if that's true.
I have to work
right
at seeing whether I can render the scene sufficiently emotionally recognizable to somebody else. Well, she actually wrote what one assumes are very literal representations of certain exchanges. They're too specific, the songs.
Right.
You know, Bob Dylan went from writing things that people stood and linked arms to sing, like in the manner of Times Are Changing and Blowing in the Wind, to writing a year later, Mr. Tambourine Man and It's All Right, Ma. The possibilities, the possibilities of song completely change in just 2 years.
Visions of Joanna.
And all these things that are, if you're a kid growing up in the era of I Want to Hold Your Hand, it's a little bit different when the same singers suddenly sing in a song that goes, was she told when she was young that pain would lead to pleasure?
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell does that mean? You know, I mean, it's, I had no idea, you know, it kind of made me feel I was attracted to it.
Yeah.
But it's going, oh, I don't know about that. You know, like, it's kind of sounds kind of sexy, but kind of in a, you know, when you're
and
14,
you say you're not sensitive. You're very sensitive to these the power of these lyrics.
You don't think
you're
that, but you don't think it's odd to kind of go, to grow up at the same pace as the, just like that, that 5 or 6 years that separate you from being able to live that experience, from being able to hear it and recognize it, you know, going from childhood to teenage.
Sure. Right? It's, well, you don't understand it, but you feel it.
Yeah. I knew it in, oddly enough, I knew it in sort of Burt Bacharach songs, because people think of those as being very, you know, restrained, and they talk about easy listening and all this nonsense.
It's very sad, some of it.
Very tragic and and kind of, you know, carnal.
Yeah,
carnal, but it's not in the words, it's in the music.
Oh yeah,
it's the music that's working on you.
What is that, that, because he does a thing that, and then you would know, but there seems to be a progression that he does that involves chords that, you know, deliver something.
Well, he knows about tension, you know, and drama.
Yeah.
And he also, you know, he wrote famously this song "Anyone Had a Heart," and people are supposed to have rebelled when he put the music down, because it's actually, when you look at it written down, it's lots of odd bars. It's not in 4/4.
Right.
Is there's funny bars, and musicians would say this is too difficult to play, and his direction was feel it, don't count it.
Right.
And if you sing it to yourself without thinking about where the bar lines are, it makes complete sense. And if you straightened it out, it wouldn't be as effective. It wouldn't be tense.
Right.
And it wouldn't represent that desperation.
Right.
And that's what I learned from listening to him. Of course, when I first heard the song, it just had a strange, unsettling effect. It took me years to to understand what it
was. To unpack it.
And then, you know, trying my pathetic way to kind of, you know, get that effect into any of my songs.
When did you start doing that?
Accidents Will Happen.
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of a feeling that I was like, if I could just get that tension where you just got to announce things just before they happen, not just like strum through the
chords, right.
You know?
And when you did it, like, so if you had a country music producer produce Almost Blue.
Yeah.
So you could, so you work through a certain amount of emotions through that. And then Imperial Bedroom is just this mind-blowing combination of a lot of things. It's complete, it seems very different than the other Four Attractions record.
Well, maybe because we'd gone and I'd worked out, you know, the things that, you know, the heartbreak side I found represented in these songs I'd chosen that nobody expected us to record, also gave me a break from writing. I wasn't writing any songs for maybe 3 months, you know.
Beyond, like, I can't, I've listened to Beyond Belief like hundreds of times.
Yeah, well, then I'd worked out what I wanted to put on the next record, and that was a much, you know, and then we also gave ourselves the liberty of this using, it was the first time I used the studio like an instrument, you know, like instead.
And you had
of,
Jeff is
Jeff Emmerich.
Jeff Emmerich, the guy who did the Beatles stuff. Which Beatles albums did he do?
Revolver and Sgt. Pepper, most famously, a lot of things. But I mean, he had also worked at Abbey Road and worked with every kind of conceivable musician. He'd worked with Judy Garland, he'd worked with orchestras, so he knew everything about mic placement and drama. And he was a musician.
Did you learn from him?
You did, but it never felt like learning. We were just doing it. And we were kind of on a voyage to try anything. Let's hire a harpsichord. Let Steve write for an orchestra. And it was, you know, we thought we were doing our sort of moment where you go in and you just let everything happen that you can imagine. And Jeff was the one who had to make it.
So after
sense.
Imperial Bedroom, do you separate your sort of your catalog of work into sections, like a period?
No,
like,
I mean,
what happens?
I don't really think in terms of albums so much after. I mean, I'm aware that, you know, like, for instance, in America, people say, oh, that great track from Miami Is True.
Yeah.
Watching the Detectives. It's not on the album. It was a single that came out between.
Right.
But so because the record came out later, it was added. And Radio is not on this year's model either. And what's so funny about Peace, Love, and Understanding is not on Armed Forces, not as we conceive them. The records had different endings. We were one of the last kind of periods of groups that actually released singles that weren't supposed to be on albums.
Was there a point where you started to honor your own vision in light of the fact that, was there a point where you said, I don't know if I, you know, if I want to chase making hit records?
No, I mean, quite the opposite. I think after the, you know, the freedom of Imperial Bedroom and imagining all these different types of songs from something like Beyond Belief, which is very, you know, sort of a different blueprint for rock and roll, and something which had an obvious model like Almost Blue, which was written as if it were a standard, you know.
Yeah.
I was trying to do all these different forms of songs that I heard in my head, and I was letting particularly Steve and my own vocal arranging, you know, take it. And then we, you know, it still seemed to matter that we had something on the radio. So we went to work with you know, a producer that could sort of tailor our record to get, you know, over to a broader audience.
Which producer?
Clive Langer and Alan Winstanley, and they made Every Day I Write the Book, which was a hit.
Huge.
But we also made Shipbuilding on the same record, which was a very serious song, and it came out of current, recent events, and it was written with Clive, you know, his music, my words. And
What was the relationship with T-Bone like? I mean, why did you seek each other out?
Well, I think then we made one more record with Clive and Alan, which was not so successful creatively. And I just sort of wanted to go back to how I did it, which was just to write the songs on the guitar and just play them.
Right.
So I went out and did that, and sort of I thought, oh, this feels right, you know.
And he was
he was there, and that led to, you know, maybe arranging the songs differently with the voice to the fore, and making King of America.
And then, like, when you started to do some of the ensemble pieces, the classical with
Brodsky Quartet,
because I remember that came out, and in my mind I was sort of like, what's he doing?
Well, I think people are going to say that, you know. I mean,
what were you exploring though? Was it sort of out of your comfort zone? Wasn't
exactly.
It?
Well, that's good. Each of these things I've described, you know, Imperial Bedroom. Some people were horrified by it because of, what's it? It's got an orchestra on it, and you know, then they've gone country. I mean, to me, it was like, well, the Birds did this. They went through all these things as they were following their feelings. The Beatles, every record. I remember as a Beatles fan thinking, oh, they've lost it now. This Sgt. Pepper, what a load of rubbish. And then I couldn't live without it. You know, it would be record would come out, and it would be such a shock because of the difference. I didn't think you were actually thought maybe educated by the records I'd loved. I felt like the next record you made should be utterly different, not the same as the one you made
before. No, that's absolutely true, but
so
that's not...
Even when it came to form, you know, by that point I started to listen to the songs that came out of classical music, and I had friends, these young friends who, you know, they played as vibrantly to me, in my mind. They played with the immediacy that I didn't hear in some rock and roll music at that time.
Right.
So I just wanted to make some music with them, and it's driven me to have to learn certain communicative skills, like the codes of music, to literally be able to write it down. Not sort of like so I can go on, put a professor's hat on, you know. It's like, it's still to just sing stories.
But was there a point where you were getting pressure to recapture whatever your last hit was? You never had that pressure from a record company or anybody? You kind
of tried it a few times, but it didn't work. What more could they do to me? You know, I mean, it's never really been very successful. I've been using their money to do what I wanted until the record business dissolved. I mean, I worked at it until it, isn't it gone now?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, we can still get music, apparently.
Apparently, yeah. But you know, I have to give credit to the people who did give me the money to do all these different experiments. And they were people that understood my side of the bargain, if my side of the bargain meant making the same record already made.
Sure.
And some people were horrified when we had it in King of America. They took it and buried it in the desert, you know.
Yeah.
And Blood and Chocolate. It's too distorted.
Yeah.
You know.
What about Spike?
It's too distorted. I mean,
Spike
too distorted. Like this. Yeah. Blood and Chocolate comes out in 86.
Yeah.
Nirvana turn up in what, 92?
Yeah.
Like, which is distorted? Which is too distorted? You know. I mean, it was just,
such
an idiotic thing. It's just music, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, there's nothing to fear, you know.
So let's talk. Like the collaboration with Burt Bacharach was, I imagine, amazing experience for you.
Well, in a way, I'd learned all these things about the you know, where it was to kind of look over his shoulder and go, oh, that's how you do it. But you know, the more amazing thing to me was the openness he had to writing music with another songwriter.
He'd never done that before
once before with Neil Diamond, and other than that he'd never written this volume of songs with anybody else, because we ended up having a musical dialogue. People always assumed I would just be the lyricist, but our first song was really quite evenly proportioned contribution musically.
Oh, that must have been exciting.
And you know, instead of like being affronted by the fact that I was writing music, he, you know, that's the great thing about him, the story isn't finished. And I learned something from him in that way, that you know, you shouldn't think that you know how it goes, because you might be surprised by the next thing you do.
You must have got through to him. If you were the first real collaborator, you must have saw something.
But then, you know, then equally he would get inside the phrases I'd written and go, oh, you need to move that note stretch the music. I mean, it was really getting within the very fabric of it.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
And what did you learn from Alan Toussaint?
I didn't learn, but I observed tremendous grace you know, in the face of what, I mean, our our collaboration began somewhat bizarrely in the early 80s, where I was asked to record a Yoko Ono song, and he ended up producing it. That was our first recording. Then he was one of the many people on Spike, a record I made with T-Bone Burnett, where we, I describe it in the book as being like Lawrence of Arabia, only with less camels. You know, it was like everything that I could ever dream of, I'd tried to do it all at once, you know, and a, sort of like a Heaven's Gate of music. You know? And but there's many songs I love on the record. I mean, it was just, we went very widescreen.
Right.
And probably one of the last records on that scale that, that any record company would bankroll, you know. And then when I came back to work with Alan Toussaint, it was, in, you know, it was right after Katrina. So it was very different circumstances.
Sure.
I just, I didn't feel like I had possession of those songs. I just had a really great opportunity to see that he went back to work very fast. And if it, even if it meant me sing and lead on that record, we just went and recorded his catalogue and a few songs that I'd written, a few songs that we'd written together. It was a unique thing to go back to New Orleans and see him go back into a studio
In the face of that devastation.
Things were barely open. There was one hotel open, one studio open. It was curfew at night. You know, you'd drive through blocks and it would all be blacked out. It was very harrowing to see some of the scenes.
Devastating.
And this is all the music that we'd ever loved, you know. And all the music was all joyful as well. And you couldn't really imagine how that could happen.
Sure.
You know?
That's what music's supposed to do in the face of that tragedy. Yeah. And the Roots, what drove you to that collaboration?
Well, I made all these records, you know, and I worked with T-Bone Burnett and again, and you know, in recent times, and we, when it came to about 2010, like you could sense it was like the options were narrowing for making records, and that being the, you can make them, but you couldn't delude yourself. It was going to be the thing that made your working life go around, like it had been.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the way it was for so many years, and then it changes, but. Hey, before there were recorded records, people played music.
Yeah.
You know, when I started out, it was only 10 or 15 years after people would buy your songs for $50.
Right.
Outright, you know. And then there's a little bit of time where it was a sort of viable business, and then now it's supposed to be free. And so I changed my mind about where I had my responsibility to my young boys and my wife, that I would make best use of my time. And I decided that would be best on the stage.
Yeah.
Because by this point, I've got more songs than I could play in one evening.
Sure.
And I could sort of tell a story out of those songs however I did
that. You
had
a choice.
Yeah, I had one show where I used a big game show.
Right, the wheel,
I had another show where I just told a story that and took the component parts of the story from songs from my songbook. I didn't imagine I would record again, and the next thing I find myself, I'm in a little airless box in NBC making Wise Up Ghosts with Questlove, and they kind of tricked me in there, really, you know. But it was good, because then you have to trust to the people that you're in the room with. The way Quest plays the drums is utterly different to the way Pete Thomas. It's not superior or there's not a competition. It's a different kind of groove.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me hear the way I place my words against it differently. And it made me think, well, I can sing these outward-looking songs. I don't have to be singing the deepest, darkest things about my own feelings.
Yeah.
I'm looking out at the world. This is a bulletin. This is a bulletin, what we're seeing all together, what we're moving through. That kind of record. I hadn't made consistently one record like that. And by the end of it, I sort of ended up writing one of the most personal songs. I wrote a literal, you know, it's called The Puppet Has Cut His Strings. It was like, they sent me, you know, the way we worked was like, here's some music, okay, and I would write, you know, here's a beat, and I would lay the parts down, and then the Roots would come in and they would substitute their plan for my plan. You know, I'd lay the bass down, and then Mark would play it, or the sousaphone would play it, and it was all arranged in a dub style, really, like a dub record. But on the very last days of recording, Quest and Ray Angry, who plays piano with them, sent me this beautiful melody, very slow beat, and it didn't feel like really the record we'd made, but it was something else again. And I don't know why, but I sat in my kitchen and wrote this very sad song about my dad's last, you know, my dad had passed like a couple of years before, and I thought, oh, I'll never write about that. It's too harrowing, you know. And it sort of was a wonderful thing, really, because it must have been in there waiting to get out. And I'd never had any reluctance to write about when things were painful or when things, you know, move me that I'd seen, that, you know, songs like Shipbuilding.
Or, yeah.
I'd never felt any inhibition, but this, I thought, well, that's just beyond me to put that into a song.
Uh-huh.
Before I knew what I'd done, I'd written it, and because I'd got a computer with, you know, a microphone in it, I'd sung it. And then I hit, then I found myself, oh, I'll hit send and send it to them. And then I went to the studio the next day and said, that's the record.
Oh my God, that's
so
beautiful.
The recording is just the little mic, the little tiny little voice. So maybe if I'd gone into the studio, I would have overthought it. I would have gone, oh no, I can't do it. No, it's too. I went in the next day, I said, no, we're not touching it. That's it.
Oh wow.
You know, because it was, you could tell that it was a, you know, and it was a very, in the end, I only mentioned the track because you don't then have to, it doesn't have to then be a hit record.
Sure.
It's the fact that it came into existence that matters. Yeah. When we sequenced the album Eyes Up Coast, we talked about opening the record with it.
Yeah.
I said, no, I don't want to hear that I don't want to hear about my father's death every time I put that record on.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure I want to put it on the record.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just glad we made the track because now it's out of my head, it's out of my heart.
Did you feel relief?
I did. Oh, I did, because I knew sooner or later I'd write about it in some way. And obviously, when I wrote this book, I wrote about things I wasn't proud of and that I'd done publicly and privately, and wrote about stupid things that happened to me, you know, in the process of an apprenticeship of learning how to be in music.
Yeah.
You know, being blown off in a club by Desmond Dekker, the reggae star, got up on my break and lip-synced 5 times to hit the Israelites.
Sure.
And I learned from that, you know, you can steal the show even when you're not actually singing. You know, and yet when I went into, you know, making records, when I was writing this book out, I realized that the first time my voice was heard on the BBC was Live Aid.
Yeah.
I was just asked to lip-sync up until then. Even though we were out every night killing and we could sing all our songs really well, they never trusted you to sing on the BBC because it was too difficult to set the band. Yeah. That was some bullshit excuse.
Yeah.
So there was always this artificial thing that was part of being in pop music and show business, starting with the name, the silly way I looked.
Yeah.
But when you get all the way through all this time, I've sung 400 songs I've written, so something like that.
Yeah.
Some of them are just songs for occasions.
Sure.
They're social music.
Yeah.
Like every day I write the book.
Yeah.
It's a 10-minute job to write a song like that.
Right.
Some of them are like very harrowing to listen to, whether they be about carnal stuff or heartbreak.
Yeah.
And some of them are life and death. You know, some of them, whether it's Shipbuilding or whether it's this puppet song, they're about somebody's end.
Yeah.
And you can't shy away from those things because that's what it's given you to write about these things.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I've been fortunate. It's just that's what I've.
Well, it's a beautiful job, and
it is actually a beautiful job.
And the fact that you sort of embrace and accept the responsibility of being a troubadour, you know, and being out there and delivering, you know, all of your work at whatever pace or however you want to do it for people is a beautiful thing.
And you know, the recordings are, you know, are something that some people really, and of course I, you know, I wouldn't be here without my, but if your parents meet across a record shop counter, records are going to be important objects to you.
Sure.
We can't pretend that they motivate the business of playing music live the same way as they did. But that doesn't mean they shouldn't exist or we shouldn't create them just for them to be as literally a record. That's where the word came from.
And also the joy of
the account, you know.
Look, for me to be able to sit with, and I'm into vinyl again, for me to be able to sit and listen to, you know, Imperial Bedroom yesterday.
Yeah.
It's beautiful, and I can do that anytime. You're not going to come play it for me in my house.
No, I might go and play it in your local theater. You know, but if you go, you know, and that's probably why I love, you know, 78 records.
Sure,
you know, because they're even a closer step back into the past.
Oh, it's time travel.
They're playing into a horn.
Yeah,
and if you just think it in your head, they were just in that room, and there's no mixing or anything.
Yeah.
They had to make those choices.
Yeah.
And Little Richard records are the same. If you play a Little Richard record off of 78 to a bunch of kids, they'll go crazy. Yeah. And it's really like, this is music we had better ban.
All right, we got to go. You got to go do a gig.
I got to go do a gig. It's nice to speak with you.
It was great. So that was Information Power Pack conversation with the amazing Elvis Costello. I hope you enjoyed that. And you can also go over to WTFpod.com, see what's up. Get a poster, get on the mailing list. Not much on my schedule because I'm working. I'm trying to keep my shit together. I'm all right.
Incoming!
Boomer lives!